Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Whatever happened to the problem of opium addiction, and who still abuses this scourge of the 1800s? Writer Stephen Martin first used the drug on a lark as a way of experiencing the local culture while traveling through Laos. After helping a journalist colleague with a story on opium use by Western backpackers in Asia, Martin's lifelong interest in collecting led him to start acquiring traditional opium paraphernalia, which over time morphed into a dependence on the drug itself, which would ultimately take over his life. He tells the story of his habit, his unorthodox recovery, and in his new memoir, Opium Fiend, a 21st century slave to a 19th century addiction. Stephen, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
So from the time you were very young, you write about this drive to collect things. Can you talk about how that took shape for you over time?
Well, yeah, that's right. I've been collecting things since I was a little kid, and the collections, as happens with a lot of young kids, the collections kind of started out with typical things that children might collect, stamps or coins or this sort of thing. And then as I got older, I started collecting other things including like medals, war medals and this sort of thing. And when I got to traveling, when I was just after high school, I started traveling in Southeast Asia. When I got to traveling and started spending a lot of time over there, I started collecting things that I'd find around Southeast Asia as well.
Do you see any relationship at all between that drive to collect and sort of an addictive personality?
Absolutely. Yes, absolutely. I think with collectors, anybody who collects or seriously collects anything, I think will be able to relate to my story. And I talk about collecting quite a bit in my memoir, Opium Fiend, because I think in order to be really successful collector, at least all the successful collectors that I've known had what you might call compulsive or obsessive personalities. They'll find something that catches their fancy, and they'll start collecting it, and it's really something they can't think about anything else. They'll just want to know everything they can about it and get as many examples as they can of it, and it just kind of takes off from there. And it seems to me that same kind of personality, an obsessive compulsive personality, if you will, also kind of takes advantage of people who get addicted to things.
Yeah. You make a distinction between collectors and what you call mere gatherers. And this was interesting to me because I don't have any impulse to collect anything. But it was an interesting insight for me into how the sort of difference would play out.
Well, I made the distinction because a lot of people gather things that they find interesting, and for example, if you do get into collecting, and there are websites you can get online, and you can look at all the different things that people collect, things that you didn't even know existed. And with most collectibles, there's usually a book out there already. Somebody has already done the research. Somebody can tell you what to look for. Somebody can even perhaps tell you where to look. And for a lot of people who collect things, let's say, for example, it could be anything, license plates or something like that. But for a lot of things like this, it's just merely, in my opinion anyway, I don't want to sound like I'm talking down on any other collectors, but they kind of gather things. They get an example of this. They get an example of that. And perhaps they display them in their homes. And as far as really doing any research or knowing much about these things, it's already there in books, and they really don't have to do a whole lot. For me, what was interesting about the opium smoking paraphernalia is when I started collecting it, I realized that there was absolutely no information out there about it. And this was as a result of opium, the drug, being so thoroughly eradicated in the late 19th century and early 20th century. There was just no information that nobody bothered to gather information about opium smoking paraphernalia back then. And once the paraphernalia had been almost completely eradicated, everything almost completely destroyed, it was very difficult for anybody to do research about it. So I kind of took this as a challenge when I first started collecting and did as much research as possible.
So you might very well be the first seaman in the history of the U.S. Armed Forces to be mildly disappointed to be sent to Hawaii when you were stationed, but you were dreaming of living in the Philippines.
That's right. I was actually trying to get stationed in the Philippines, which at the time had a base, a naval base at Subic Bay. And I had been traveling in the Philippines before I joined the Navy. I actually made my first trip there when I was 18. I'm from San Diego originally. And I traveled over there a bit, two times. I made two trips over there, actually, and one of them in 1983. I lived there for 6 months. So I came back to San Diego thinking that there must be some way to get over to Southeast Asia and travel more or base myself there. And I hit upon joining the Navy, of course, because I'm from San Diego and it's a Navy town. But I ended up in Hawaii, in Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, which wasn't too bad because I was still able to make trips to Southeast Asia when I had leave.
So, Stephen, tell me about what you see as the source of your fascination with Asian culture, because as you describe your upbringing, you're from sort of a middle class white bread family from Southern California.
That's right. Well, it's kind of interesting. I had a my great grandfather, my father's grandfather was worked with Chinese in California building irrigation canals during the early 20th century. He was a foreman of a gang of Chinese workers who built these irrigation canals. And as a result of this, I think he probably himself had a fascination with his workers' culture, and he started collecting himself. So when I was a very young boy, I was exposed to this collection of my great-grandfather. He had a collection of miniature jades and some other curios, including some of those, one pair of those silk slippers, the very tiny miniature silk slippers that women with bound feet used to wear. Mm. And this sort of captured my imagination at a very young age. I remember being maybe 5, 6 years old and making trips over to my grandparents' house and seeing this collection in a curio cabinet and being fascinated by it from a very, very young age. And I guess that's what kind of started me on that road.
So you eventually settled in Thailand. You learned the language. Initially, though, your visas required you to leave every few months and return, but you actually enjoyed that because you were able to travel throughout Asia.
That's right. Every 3 months I had to leave and get a new visa, but this was really just a good excuse to get out and travel, to go to the neighboring countries, Laos, Cambodia, Vietnam, Burma, Malaysia, Singapore. And as a result of this travel, I started writing freelance for various publications and the wire services, the Associated Press and Agence France-Presse, because I was seeing all these things. I was running across all these interesting things and getting ideas for stories, and I happened to have a group of friends in Thailand who were journalists in Bangkok, who were journalists, and who helped me get some of these stories placed. And as it worked back then, once you placed a few stories here and there and the editors got to know you, it became quite easy after that.
So your first experience with opium, Stephen, was in Laos. Talk a little bit about what opium dens were like in the capital at the time.
Well, actually, they were very, very rustic. And I should explain first that the whole idea, the whole reason for there being an opium den is because preparing opium into the traditional Chinese manner, which preparing it for smoking, which is actually a misnomer, I should say, where the paraphernalia that's used to so-called smoke opium actually vaporizes the drug. It doesn't smoke it. But this paraphernalia is very difficult to use. There's a very specialized lamp. There's a very specialized pipe. The lamp is the heating source, and it takes a lot of practice to be able to use these pieces. And so in the old days, when there were a lot of opium smokers, people would go to an opium den, not so much to be with other opium smokers, but because there were attendants on hand who would prepare the drug for the patrons. So, but back to your question, in Laos at the time, in Wing Chun, which is the capital of Laos, at the time, these places, there were only a couple of them left. There were, even then, there were real anachronisms. The last one closed in 2002, and they were very rustic. They were just ghosts of what opium dens would have been like 100 years ago, when there were a lot of opium smokers and these places were very well patronized.
And it sounds like there was something about the sort of formality and structure of the almost ceremony of preparing those trays to smoke opium that appealed to you initially, at least as much as the high itself.
That's true. I found myself, well, first of all, I really kind of was attracted to the paraphernalia. I thought the paraphernalia was really interesting because, first of all, I knew nothing about it before reporting on this story or helping to report on this story in Laos about the remnants of opium smoking and getting a look at some of these opium pipes and things. And I started thinking, this might be an interesting thing to collect. And then when I started really looking into it, I realized that a lot of these pieces were very different. This paraphernalia was different from what I'd seen in Laos, in that the genuine old pieces that were being used, the old pipes, the old lamps that were being used back during opium's heyday, were very ornate. They were beautiful works of art, really, made of the finest materials, the natural materials, obviously, back then, that man could come up with, things like ivory and jade and silver, and you know, often they were encrusted with jewels and this sort of thing. So I thought this was really interesting, because if you think about it, these pieces of paraphernalia to smoke this narcotic are actually instruments of self-destruction, mm-hmm. yet they were also very beautiful works of art. And I was attracted to this. I thought this was interesting. But to answer your question, when I started doing research, and by research I mean that I started going into these opium dens in Wuyangjun and actually watching these old smokers, and at the time the people who were still smoking were all very old, maybe 70, 80 years old, and watching them prepare, I was struck by the ritual of the whole thing. There was a lot of ritual involved. It wasn't an easy thing to do. It was obviously a skill and something that these old smokers were very proud of.
So to explain to people about this journalistic assignment, you had this colleague, Carl Taro Greenfeld, who wanted to report on Western backpackers traveling through Laos and sort of experiencing opium dens. But he says to you, look, I'm a recovering heroin addict. I can't go in there and smoke myself. Will you do it for me so that I can write about what it's like?
That's right. That's how it came about. And I had known Carl for a while. He was working at Time Asia in their Hong Kong office, and he would sometimes come to Thailand or other places in Southeast Asia and look for stories to do. At the time, I had been working quite a bit on guidebooks. I was working for two different publishers, an Australian one called Lonely Planet and a British one called Rough Guides, and I updated guidebooks to, well, every country in Southeast Asia, with the exception of Vietnam and Indonesia. I've been to every one of these countries and worked on guidebooks in every one of these countries. So I had a pretty good idea what was going on in these places, and Carl would often ask me if I had any ideas for stories. And this was an idea I came up with for him. This I noticed that there was kind of a small resurgence of opium smoking in this one town north of the capital of Laos, where backpackers were passing through, and it was quite a scene, and I thought Carl would be interesting to do a story about this, and he in turn hired me to be a translator and a fixer and kind of help him interview people in the local language.
Let me jump in here. We have to take a quick break. Stephen Martin is my guest. He's a journalist and author of the memoir Opium Fiend, a 21st century slave to a 19th century addiction. We'll come back to our conversation with Stephen in a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen Martin. His new memoir is called Opium Fiend, a 21st century slave to a 19th century addiction. You can be part of the conversation at 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Stephen, at the time of the completion of this assignment with Carl Taro Greenfeld, you were not yet addicted to opium. You were beginning to be really fascinated by collecting these pipes, and we'll get back to that in a minute. But can you talk about your first few experiences? Because it sounds like you have to sort of push past the nausea and the discomfort to even want to come back and smoke again.
Yes, that's right, Chris. Opium is really kind of odd in that it's the exact opposite of what we hear about these modern drugs where you try it once and you're hooked for life and you can't stop doing it. Opium is actually just completely the opposite. Usually the first time anybody tries opium, it makes you nauseous and it's not a very good feeling. And my first couple of tries involved a lot of vomiting. So it's something that I'm kind of embarrassed to say it, but you almost have to be trying to get hooked to opium to really get hooked.
Was there part of you as you began to deal with other collectors, some of whom smoked or vaporized a purer form of the drug, was there part of you that found a romance in being hooked on this thing?
Well, as I said, it took a long time to get hooked. As for romance, yes, of course. I thought it was a very interesting kind of thing. As I said, it was an anachronism that there was still anything left. Laos being the only country in Southeast Asia where opium smoking lasted in the traditional Chinese manner, where opium smoking lasted all the way into the 21st century. And so I saw this, and I'd already been living in Southeast Asia, traveling in Southeast Asia for over 20 years, and noticing that things were changing very rapidly in the region. You understand that when I first went over there in the early 80s, it wasn't long after the Vietnam War had ended.
Yeah.
And Southeast Asia was still seen as kind of a scary place in the same way that people might think of the Middle East nowadays. So there weren't that many travelers. It was still kind of off the beaten path. But over the years, there was so much change and there were so many more tourists coming in and all the countries there were modernizing and opening up. And to find something like this, opium smoking, still alive, still existing, albeit in a very, very small way, I found fascinating.
So what does it feel like once you get past the nausea and all that to take this drug, and can people tell that you are high when you smoked a pipe or two?
No, actually. The one thing about opium is it's very, very difficult for anybody to know that you've been smoking as long as you've been smoking very high quality opium and in moderation. And this was one of the reasons, actually, that the drug was very popular in China during the late Qing Dynasty, is because unlike alcohol, you could indulge in opium smoking and you wouldn't lose yourself. You wouldn't mm-hmm. embarrass yourself in public or something like this. Also, when you're smoking very high quality opium and in moderation, it's conducive to work, both physical and mental. I found that I had no problems writing on it, and in fact, a lot of the chapters of much of my book was based on notes that I took all the time when I was, during the many years that I was smoking. I kept very detailed notes the whole time I was experimenting, and even when I was very deeply hooked on it, I still kept notes just because I was very interested in what I was going through, and I knew of no other book where anybody had described this. I had a small library of old Victorian era books, late 19th century, early 20th century books that described opium smoking, but not in such detail. And so I knew that I'd come across something kind of rare something that nobody else knew much about, so I thought that I should take a lot of notes and really kind of explore what I was going through.
Did you pause at all, Stephen, before publishing this account, thinking, okay, the folks at the Associated Press may not take kindly to the fact that, some of the reports I sent back, I may have been under the influence while doing the reporting?
Actually, by the time that I started doing, that I started getting into opium smoking heavily, I was no longer doing much for the wire services. Mm-hmm. And I had, at that time, I was working more for the guidebooks. So, but
and they don't have a problem with it?
Well, I suppose if they go back and they read it now, they may have a problem with it. But all I can do now is apologize for it. I'm no longer addicted to the drug, and yes, I agree it was irresponsible of me, but I tried to write a book that was completely honest.
No, and I have to say it's remarkably candid, and you are honest about things that other people, I think, in the name of making themselves look a little bit better, wouldn't have done. One of the remarkable things you do, you open this book with an account of one of several attempts you made to sort of quit on your own, and you're going through withdrawal. And the assumption is, and I don't think we're giving away too much here, the assumption is that that chapter, that first chapter, will conclude with you finally being done. And it is such a shock and such a blow to us as readers to realize, oh, you, at the end of this, you just fail all over again.
Right, right. Well, what I wanted to try and get across to readers was just the absolute hell that I went through trying to quit. And one of the things that I got from reading old accounts, old books about opium smoking, was that people who had been smoking for a long time, people who were actually addicted to it as opposed to just experimenting, often died of their withdrawal symptoms. And so I was really kind of, I just didn't know where to turn because I had these old books. They were written in that kind of late Victorian way. They were a bit shrill, and I wasn't sure exactly whether to believe them or not, if I was really in danger of actually perishing from the withdrawal. So I had to be ready just in case I couldn't go any further. And I lasted about 3 days before I broke down and started smoking again. But it was absolutely, after I'd been smoking for a long period of time and on a daily basis, it was absolutely impossible for me to quit without assistance.
Well, we will talk about that assistance in a moment. I want to go to the phones now, though, at 1-800-933-5372. We have Ken on the line in Plano. Hi, Ken.
Yes, hi. In my experience with people around me and my own behavior, addiction is about distraction. It's about distracting one's conscious and subconscious from larger issues, whether it's the way you were raised or sometimes it's just the communication internally is just bad. I was wondering if you'd like to talk about what were you distracting yourself from? What issues, core issues, were you attempting to avoid during your addiction? Thank you.
It's an interesting question, Ken, because it's not something that you really address very much in the book, Stephen.
I don't think I was really trying to distract myself from anything. Again, it was more about, I looked at it, now in retrospect it sounds silly, but I looked at it as though I was doing research. And I met a couple of other individuals there who had access to good quality opium and who were also smoking on a regular basis. And I found myself hanging out with them more and more and being able to relate to them more and more. And then as it went on, I could only relate to them. I couldn't really relate to anybody else once I'd really gotten into it. But it was more that, more of a research thing. And I think anybody who reads the book will kind of see that when it comes to the paraphernalia itself, when it comes to opium smoking paraphernalia, I really am quite obsessed with it, and I really wanted to learn everything there was to know about it, and I saw opium smoking as a way to do that.
I know that you've donated much of your collection to a university. I wonder if you fight those cravings to continue acquiring things as much as you continue to fight occasional cravings to smoke.
Absolutely, absolutely. In fact, I still, if I can, when I, if and when I can afford it, I still acquire things, and I'm constantly studying. I have a small group of collector friends who I'm still very close with, and they're still collecting, and they often ask my opinion of things before they purchase them. So I'm still very much within that collector community, and although I don't really have the money to be collecting things as much as I used to, partly because the prices have just gone up astronomically since my first book came out. I did a picture book about collecting opium smoking paraphernalia that was published in 2007. And since that time, interest has gone up quite a bit. So where I used to be able to find pipes for less than $100, now they're selling for several thousand dollars. So I can't afford to buy things like I used to.
I thought it was really fascinating that one of your chief motivations in recognizing you needed to get clean and be free of this addiction was the fact that your need to take the drug, your working less, was threatening your collection. You were having to sell off pieces to buy a fix.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's what it came down to. I had these two obsessions, and they were at loggerheads, basically. It was going to be one or the other, and I had to choose. And I knew, even while smoking opium, I was very lucid about what my situation was, even while I was completely addicted to it. I knew that the collection wouldn't last and that I would end up selling everything and have absolutely nothing to show for it. So I knew one had to go, and I knew which one had to go.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phones next to Lauren in Carrollton. Hi, Lauren.
Lawrence.
Oh, excuse me, Lawrence. Hi.
Oh, hello. Your guest is great today. I just wanted to say I've got, I'm looking at a nice opium pipe sitting on my mantle at the moment, and it's a very beautifully crafted design. I'm very happy to have gotten that at a reasonable price in the past. I just wanted to mention that there are two authors, and I just wanted to ask if you had had some familiarity with them. One is Nick Tosius, and the other one is Peter Lee, and both of them have written extensively on opium use in the contemporary age. But I wanted to ask about the difference in your mind between the old opium dens and what were called flower houses, which were the more aristocratic places to go and smoke opium and, you know, have a chef there with a variety of other attendants and such.
Well, you do mention those writers in the book, certainly, Stephen.
I do mention both of those writers, that's right. And I won't go into depth with it here other than to say that I talk about both of them at length in the book. And I discovered the writing of both of those authors early on, and kind of followed these clues to their conclusion, and they led me to some interesting places. So if you read my memoir Opium Fiend, you'll see where that went.
And Lawrence, another question about flower houses. Did you look into those very much?
Well, we use the word in English. We use the word opium den, and this kind of is a blanket term that everybody understands that means an opium smoking establishment. But there were opium smokers of every class. Mm-hmm. It was actually, quite a common vice 100 years ago, not only in China, but also in the United States. And North America, Canada also had a problem with it. And there were opium dens or opium smoking establishments that were created for people of every class. And for the people who had a lot of money, there were very elaborate places, especially in China. There were very elaborate opium smoking establishments that had attendants of other kinds that the caller alluded to, which were actually prostitutes. So people could come in and they could smoke opium and I suppose get a massage or whatever, and also bisexual favors. There was probably food on offer and music on offer. But a place like this would also have had alcohol. So it wasn't really an opium den in the strictest sense. Yes, there was opium being prepared and dispensed there, But if people were going there, perhaps not primarily for that, they could go there for other reasons as well.
You have some really interesting history in the book. I have to confess, I suppose to the extent I had thought about it at all, I assumed that the practice of smoking opium had really, really ancient roots. But in fact, it really didn't take hold even in Asia until about 200 years ago.
That's right. Interestingly, my theory anyway, that is, if it wasn't for the Chinese actually inventing a pipe that allowed opium to be vaporized, opium probably would never have been used recreationally on such a large scale. And that's because opium used in other ways, for example, eating or smoking, mixing it with tobacco, it doesn't have the same effect. The high, if you will, isn't as enjoyable as opium when it's vaporized. And also there are some very kind of severe side effects to opium when opium is eaten, most specifically constipation, severe constipation. So opium wasn't really, it didn't take off as a recreational drug until the Chinese invented this system for vaporizing opium, probably sometime in the 18th century. We're not even sure exactly when that happened. But opium smoking paraphernalia that's used for vaporizing opium, the pipes and the lamps, aren't much older than about the late 1700s.
And the most prized specimens were crafted in Vietnam?
Yes, in my opinion, the Vietnamese were the best craftsmen of all. Of course, they used the same design as the Chinese. They used the same type of they were making the same type of pipe and lamps, but their creativity with adornment was just fantastic. And I think a lot of that has to do with the fact that Vietnam, Indochina as it was called back then, was colonized by the French. And there were a lot of French people living there, and the French also got quite a bit into opium smoking back then. And some of these French smokers introduced different schools of art to Vietnam, such as Art Nouveau and the sort of thing that the Vietnamese artisans then applied to opium pipes. So you have some very beautiful pieces that were made in Vietnam.
Let me jump in here. We need to take a quick break. My guest is journalist Stephen Martin, author of the new memoir, Opium Fiend, a 21st century slave to a 19th century addiction. We'll be back in about 2 minutes. Our number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is journalist Stephen Martin, author of the new memoir Opium Fiend, a 21st century slave to a 19th century addiction. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org. So, Stephen, you make the decision that you need some help if you're going to kick this addiction. And ultimately, you find your way to this remarkable facility run by Buddhist monks in rural Thailand. Tell us about how you heard about the place and how it became a drug treatment facility to begin with.
Well, yeah, that's right, Chris. I was actually very lucky that it turned out there was this Buddhist monastery not far from where I was living, about an hour and a half's drive north of Bangkok, that in the early 60s, right around 1960, started a drug treatment program specifically for opium smokers. And this was because Thailand was rather late in banning the drug. It wasn't banned until right around 1960. And when it was banned, there were, at the time, a lot of people who were addicted to it, but there were not too many clinics out there that were set up for treating these people. And so this same monastery is still there, and they still have this detox facility within the monastery, but nowadays they actually see very, very few opium smokers. In fact, the only one of the really older monks had remembered even the last time they even had one there in treatment, and everybody was very surprised to see somebody there who was addicted to opium, and not only that, have that person be a foreigner. But yes, I was very lucky that this place even existed. And again, you know, for the most part, the people who were being treated there are being treated for all kinds of addictions.
One of the other surprising departures of this book from the standard sort of format for the addiction memoir is the fact that you write about getting there and the monks are surprised to see you, this Westerner, addicted to opium. And you had this weird sensation of pride that you had this unusual addiction, even though you were well aware that this thing was destroying your life. Can you help us understand that?
Yeah, it's hard to explain, and it does sound kind of ridiculous without having, you know, reading the book and seeing the details. But a lot of the there was, I did actually feel in this strange way, I felt proud that I seemed to be in, at least in the eyes of the others, so unusual or unique, if you will. But at the same time, I also realized that thinking too much in this way was going to be counterproductive, and that my, you know, I had to get off this stuff, whether I felt unique about having been addicted to it or not. I just had to get off it.
What were the conditions set forth for you to be accepted into the program?
Well, you have to sign on for at least 5 days, and they're actually very strict about one thing and one thing only, and that is if you ever have a relapse, you will not be allowed back in for another try. The monastery itself claims that this detox program, there's actually a special potion that you have to drink, and you drink it 5 days in a row, and this potion, actually, it's not something that you hold or that you digest. You're supposed to purge it. You're supposed to vomit it up after drinking. And the idea being that this potion kind of sucks the toxins out of your body and detoxifies you very rapidly. So it's not an easy thing to do. But there were a lot of people there doing it. There were about 50 addicts there total. Besides myself, the majority of them were locals, were Thai, but there were also a handful of Westerners who were there for a number of things. Most of them were Europeans.
And when you were finished, it's not that you never touched opium again, but the few times you tried it, it did nothing for you.
That's right. I stayed clean of it for several months. And then I slipped back into it. But to my surprise, I was unable to enjoy opium the way I had enjoyed it before I took the cure. And I found that very frustrating at first. But without spoiling the book and explaining too much about it, there was a reason after my relapse, a very large tragedy in my life that caused me to stop doing it completely. And luckily, I had only been smoking for a short period of time. Luckily for me, anyway, I had only been smoking for a short period of time when this tragedy struck, and I was able to quit again without any assistance. But this tragedy came at a great price to myself and especially to a very dear friend of mine.
How do you explain your initial success with this treatment? And I want to have no disrespect whatsoever for the Buddhist faith or for the traditions, but this is not necessarily something based in science. Do you know why it worked for you?
I don't. I can't explain it. And I try to explain in the book that it wasn't something that I really would have believed in if somebody had told me about it. And I didn't actually have any, and I didn't have any need of it. It probably something I wouldn't have taken a lot of stock in. But as it happened, this was sort of a last resort for me. I'd been trying to quit on my own. I wasn't able to, and I needed to do something. And here was this monastery who took people free of charge, and they didn't guarantee you anything. They just told you that they would get They would get you off the drug. They would break the addiction for you. And then everything else after that was up to you, that once you left the monastery, you would have to basically confront your own demons and keep yourself from becoming addicted again. And they explained right up front that that was going to be the hard part, that what I had actually done at the monastery, getting off the opium, was the easy part, and then staying off would be the hard part. They were very clear about that.
And has that proven to be the case for you?
Yes, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. It's something that, as anybody who's had an addiction, I think, would agree, it's something that never goes away. You constantly have to live with it. You have to live with this nagging, niggling feeling in the back of your head that's pushing you to do something that you know is self-destructive.
You were taught some mantras that you have used successfully over time.
Well, they give each person who, on the last day there at the monastery, they give each person a mantra, and you're supposed to memorize it, and you're supposed to say it to yourself to kind of help you be strong when the feeling hits you that you want to try opium. It's just something to kind of strengthen your resolve.
So tell me what's better in your life and what's worse in your life, if anything, since you've quit.
Well, what's better, obviously, is that, as with any addiction, opium smoking becomes this incredible ball and chain, and even more so than other drugs, because unlike other drugs where you might be tempted to hide them and take them with you and continue to smoke wherever you go or to use wherever you go, with opium, that's just not possible because the paraphernalia is so distinctive. It's large. It's not something that you could put in your pocket and walk around with, sort of deal. So that being free of this ball and chain is really, of course, this is really a good thing. Some of the worst things about it, well, it's, again, like I said, I tried to be very, very honest about how I felt about opium smoking while I was doing it regularly, while I was addicted to it. And even when things were very, very low for me and I knew that I had to stop, it was still such a pleasurable experience that getting myself to stop was difficult.
So what does writing this memoir represent to you? Is it a sort of insurance policy against a relapse?
Not at all. Actually, what this was, as I said, from my earlier research, when I started doing research, I realized that here nobody had ever chronicled the experiences of an opium smoker from A to Z. It had just never been done, and I find this really amazing because at one time it was a very, very common drug, but it's just never been done. And so perhaps because, 100 years ago people didn't write addiction memoirs, so I thought that getting my experiences down was important and would hopefully be kind of a warning to other people. But at the same time, as you know from reading the book, I cover a lot of history of opium smoking. I talk about I've dug up all kinds of little tidbits about opium smoking when I was doing research about it, and I put that in the book as well. So it's not strictly an addiction memoir. It's also part history of opium smoking and part travelogue as well, because I traveled all over Asia and even to Europe while I was doing the research.
You write that you imagine someday, if you are quite infirm or very old and it doesn't matter anymore, that you might allow yourself to go back to smoking.
That was just a pipe dream. That was really nothing more than that. It really would be pretty much impossible for somebody who is very sick or very infirm to even smoke opium, because it takes a lot of strength to to huff on the pipe and to get that opium to vaporize. So that was something, as I said, I used to kind of occupy my mind by telling myself that. I used to try and keep myself, kind of console myself by telling myself that. But in actuality, that could never really happen.
By the way, Stephen, why is it that people who are smoking opium recline to do that?
Well, the reclining has to do with the fact that the lamp, the opium lamp, is used as a heating source. And only by lying down and propping your head up on what's called an opium pillow, which is actually a ceramic block that allows the head to be held at just the right position so that you can monitor the opium as it's attached to the pipe and being held over the lamp. Because the opium, it's a very delicate process, and if the opium is held too close to the lamp, it'll burn. And if the opium burns instead of vaporizing, it's pretty much ruined. So that's the whole reason for lying down.
Have all these experiences influenced the way you cover other people who are traveling or what they might want to see when they travel? Has it had any impact on your career?
Well, I'm no longer doing the guidebooks, if that's what you mean.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't done any of those for a while. And in fact, for the last 3 years, I've been pretty much working on this book constantly. So I haven't done a lot of, I haven't done much other writing at all since finishing this book. And now I'm in the process of trying to think of something else to write about.
Yeah, I guess that's always something, you know, you have completed this story of your life, but it's not your entire life. It's just one aspect of it.
Right, right. That's correct.
Was it hard to shop this to a publisher? Did people immediately get what you were trying to do?
It wasn't that difficult, actually. I had a couple of friends helping me, a couple of friends that were published authors, helping me look around. And it actually happened very, very quickly. I'd written a couple of sample chapters and a synopsis, and it took about a month, maybe. It wasn't even that long before there was some interest, and I was offered one publisher offered to buy it. I ended up going with another publisher, but that was after I'd gotten an agent, and the agent was able to get a favorable book deal.
And the last thing I want to ask you about is you said you still, when you have money here and there, are trying to acquire these paraphernalia. Do you? Is there anything else you've become interested in collecting since then?
Well, there's one other thing I collect, but it has absolutely nothing to do with opium, antique opium smoking paraphernalia, or Asia. And I'm still collecting those, and that's vintage Western shirts, cowboy shirts. I've got a biggish collection of those from around 1950s, 60s, and 70s, and I only buy the ones that are made in the USA or Canada.
Well, you need to come visit us in Texas, because you could find those in a lot of stores.
I'm sure I could.
The new memoir by author Stephen Martin is called Opium Fiend, a 21st century slave to a 19th century addiction. Stephen, it's been really interesting. Thank you so much for sharing your story with us.
Thank you, too, Chris. Thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show and find out about upcoming programs, plus download the free daily podcast online at kera.org/think. Think at kera.org is the email address for comments, questions, or suggestions about the show. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.